Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Happy Friday to one and all, along with Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And Jim, we talked certainly a lot earlier in the week about the New Hampshire primary, but there's another New Hampshire story that we need to tell here, and this comes from Project Veritas. And if you haven't heard of Project Veritas, perhaps you've heard of James O'Keefe. He was the original acorn pimp. He was the one who surreptitiously taped NPR executives, basically bashing conservatives at a swanky dinner in Washington, D.C. Well, this time they decided to see what was going on in New Hampshire because Governor John Lynch, a Democrat up there, had vetoed legislation requiring photo ID for voters at the polls, something that a lot of other states have done as well. And so voters, because of that veto, did not have to present that ID. So these folks decided to look up a number of folks who had died recently and then see if they could still get ballots for those folks. And here's what happened.
Do you know Roger Grew? G-R-O-U-X? It's 191 Roger. Morgan.
What is the address?
191 Morgan.
That's it. We have you here. You're a Republican.
And so then Governor John Lynch was asked to respond to it. He believes the law may have been broken, and we're still checking into that. It may have, and if that's the case, that obviously should not have happened. But apparently the governor only concerned about that, not concerned about whether or not voter fraud actually happened.
I think it is outrageous that we have these out-of-staters coming into New Hampshire, coming into our polling places and misrepresenting themselves to the election officials. And I hope that they should be prosecuted to the fullest extent of the law if, in fact, they are found guilty of some criminal act.
Now, Jim, we don't condone lawbreaking if, in fact, that is what happened, but we don't know that for sure. But apparently the governor is not at all concerned about lawbreaking and prosecuting people to the fullest extent of the law if, in fact, there's voter fraud going on. And we know for a fact from folks like Christian Adams over at Pajamas Media, he used to work in the Justice Department, that Eric Holder and others in the Voting Rights Division have actually ordered people not to scrub the voting rolls of dead people. So if you think this was only a little bit of a quirk in New Hampshire, that's not true. So good for Project Veritas, at least in the area of putting this back out on the front page.
You know, perhaps most disturbing about this, Greg, is that James O'Keefe did this while dressed as a zombie. And, two interesting thoughts. The first thing is that obviously, look, the only thing he had to give was a name and an address. So theoretically, if I know where Greg Corumbus lives, if Virginia was as lax as New Hampshire is, thankfully I believe it is not, I could just, show up, give you her address, and vote for you. I mean, that's like an invitation to do this sort of thing. Now, there'll be some who'd be saying that, look, hasn't, O'Keefe broken the law in an effort to illustrate how, a big problem? And I think we could probably argue that I hope James O'Keefe did not actually cast any ballots in the names of these deceased people. That would be wrong. Now, having said that, the fact that the governor isn't bothered by this just tells you everything you need to know about the Democrats, that they either really consciously believe that nobody would ever try to do this and that only some out – I love how it's the out-of-stater, as if, James – as if no New Hampshireite could ever possibly do this sort of thing. What's to prevent somebody from, some acorn-style organization deciding, I'm just going to go through the obituaries, get the names and addresses, and go up and show up to various polling places and vote in their name. What I kind of find fascinating is that apparently, again, and I think about my voting experiences here in Virginia, they only ask for my name and my address, even though I show a voter ID card and my photo ID. But there's no listing of age. You know what I'm saying? I mean, I wonder maybe that would be a useful way of deterring this sort of thing that, you figure these people were, if O'Keefe got these names from obituaries, people who had died fairly recently, then probably most of these people are elderly, at least we certainly hope so. And so if you show up and, it says your birth date is listed in the records, well, this person's supposed to be, 70-some years old and O'Keefe shows up in his pimp hat and, for a lined jacket and all that stuff, then maybe say, hey, wait a minute, something's going on here. But again, also in that case, you need poll workers who want to find voter fraud. I think a lot of us are just not all that trusting of poll workers, a sneaking suspicion that everybody is kind of – nobody goes to work for the polls because they, with absolute total objectivity. People who work at polls have the exact same – opinions we do. Everybody's got, candidates they prefer. And so the question is, will they really enforce the rules honestly and fairly for both sides? Obviously the vast majority of poll workers, I think, are perfectly fine, decent folks. But it doesn't take too many bad ones to start creating a real issue.
And Project Veritas claims that they did not actually cast any ballots that they got through trying to see if they would hand out ballots to dead people. So that's good if, in fact, that's true. But
a fun question would be, is it voter fraud just if you misrepresent yourself? is the crime the casting of the ballot, or is the crime the misrepresenting yourself to get the ballot? I very much prefer the former to be considered criminal activity as well as the latter.
On to number two now. And Jim, we just mentioned earlier this week that it was great to see Gabby Giffords at the one-year anniversary of that horrific event in Tucson. She was there. She recited the Pledge of Allegiance. Her recovery has been amazing. It's yet to be seen whether she'll be able to recover to the point to run for re-election or not. But then, of course, we were reminded of the horrific reaction to that and the instant knee-jerk blaming of Sarah Palin, crosshair targets on congressional districts and everything else for the reason this complete nut job, Jared Loeffner, went there and killed a bunch of people and wounded Gabby Giffords and others. Somehow the question came up to Democratic National Chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, who didn't specifically blame the Tea Party for the shooting this time, but she pretty much went there again.
The discourse in America, the discourse in Congress in particular, to answer your question very specifically, has really changed. And I'll tell you, I hesitate to place blame, but I have noticed it take a very precipitous turn towards edginess and a lack of civility with the growth of the Tea Party movement.
Now, Jim, yesterday on Fox, Greg Gutfeld said that Debbie Wasserman Schultz was the greatest thing to happen to the Republican Party since Ronald Reagan. I'm not sure if I'd go that far, but she is such a bomb thrower. And if anyone pays any modicum of attention to her, you have to assume that you can't believe a word she says, because everything that comes out of her mouth isn't even remotely plausible a lot of the time. And when you compare to Reince Priebus, who is very measured, and yes, he's not exactly objective because he's the chairman of the Republican Party, the trust factor and the believability factor, definitely a huge gap between the two. And for Debbie Wasserman Schultz to go back here again after finally getting past that over the past year is just disgusting.
Debbie Wasserman Schultz hesitates to place blame, but not that much.
Apparently not.
For a moment or two, and then she just goes right ahead. The one thing I would kind of observe about this that is it's frustrating, and I think it illuminates a great deal about modern politics, is the absolute lack of connection between recognizing we need a more civil politics and then turning around and saying, and the other side is responsible for everybody being uncivil. You know, last night on The Daily Show, John Oliver spoke to Froma Harrop, who's with the paper somewhere up in New England, who's head of some like National Association of Editorial Writers board that is supposed to promote civility, and she also wrote the Tea Partiers are terrorists. And you know, John Oliver just tears her apart, pointing out the contradiction in this, and she's utterly oblivious to the, you know, the fact that you can't call for civility and then say my opposition are terrorists, and you say, well, you mean figuratively? It's no, they really are terrorists. They really are trying to drive the economy off the cliff. You know. And the audience is just guffawing at the lack of, you know, the total disconnection there. I think this phenomenon is more common than we think, that we only, like, somehow psychologically we're conditioned to see flaws in other people, and we have enormous blind spots to our own flaws. And we all know about, you know, removing the beam from our own eyes before pointing out the mote in somebody else's, but in politics, there really does not seem to be any type of consequence for this. I mean, you and I are going to object to this, and Reince Priebus did his best to kind of say, you know, you know, world, pay attention to what she's saying. Can you believe this? And, you know, I mean, it's not like, you know, she got rebuked by anybody. It's not like she got, you know, any major pushback from this. She'll be out doing this tomorrow. You just kind of get this point where, like, there really isn't consequences to making statements like this anymore. And the fact that Debbie Wasserman Schultz said something like this is not really the bad martini. I think the fact that she said it yesterday, she'll say it tomorrow, and that this is just what she does, is saying that, you know, the world is uncivil and it's those bastards on the other side that are doing it. You know, like, that's what our world is our political scene has come to. And if you wonder why people are disinterested in politics and don't want to partake in it and find the whole thing to be a clown car freak show, I think phenomena like this are a big part of it.
Maybe we should call her DC Debbie along the lines of Baghdad Bob, because she's gotten to the point where everything she says is so completely unbelievable that we should just enjoy it for its entertainment value than actually try to rebut it point by point, because it would be much easier in our blood pressure. On to number three now, our crazy martini. This one's not super crazy, but it definitely shows that some media organizations just want to be getting in on the story even when there's no story to be gotten in on. And the Bain Capital story certainly has gone from a minor story up in New Hampshire to exploding just before the primary day, and now it's kind of dominating all the coverage down in South Carolina as well. So with Bain being a financial firm, CNBC wants to get in on it, and thinking they had an interesting angle here is that they thought Mitt Romney's former firm was part of a team consulting companies that advised President Obama on a decision to close down car dealerships as he was navigating his way through the auto bailout. Well, turns out there's more than one Bain. Bain & Company is where Mitt Romney worked. Bain Consulting was one of the companies affiliated with advising Obama. Sorry about that. Jim, a little bit of egg on the face there.
This just handed to me by Emily Latella. Never mind. there's a couple things that jump out about this. One, if you're starting up a consulting firm, just call it Bain and imagine all the job, all the offers and the reputation you'd have just because everybody would think you're the other Bain. Secondly, of all the places that could make this error, CNBC you'd think would be the one that would be kind of most familiar with the world of consulting firms and all of this stuff. And it's kind of interesting that in the article itself, it makes this interesting thing of, by 2010, by the Special Inspector General for the TARP program reveals that Bain, referred to as Bain Consulting, was there. And that would be the first thing that would jump out at you. But if
right.
it's known as Bain & Company, why is it being referred to? Look, it's, you know, obviously one of the things they do is consulting. The other thing which is worth noting is that we're talking about decisions made in you know, the beginning of the Obama administration when Romney had not been at Bain & Company for like 20 years. So the idea that somehow the decisions of – even if they had been the same Bain, the idea that these decisions somehow reflect on Obama would not be – terribly logical to where I sit, but you know, this is the state of the politics that we're in. They got the headline that they wanted out of this, which is to say, Romney's firm advised Obama. Romney's primary opponents were happy to tout this to the you know, screaming from the rooftops, and you know, hopefully people will get the correction. I'd also like to note that Bain & Company did not break the back of Batman. comic book fans. They are also not a character on The Simpsons, is not an ethnic group in Cameroon, and is not a town in Iran either. So it's only one Bain. Yeah, I mean, in retrospect, if you're going to form a consulting company or an investment banking company or any of these things, pick a really precise name, okay? Because otherwise, you know, you never know in 20, 30 years, you know, 40 years down the road, your former CEO may end up be running for president and having complicated problems like this. So pick, you know, Ichabod Ishmael or something like that, something completely on something no one would ever copy or be able to be mistaken for.
Exactly. That'll be good for your Google searches, too. So
there you go.
Good advice all the way around. Jim, have a great weekend. We'll talk to you again on Monday.
Looking forward to it, Greg.
Jim Garrity of National Review. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Thanks so much for listening. Please be sure to join us again on Monday as we bring you the next edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.